Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
We've seen what it's done in Indonesia, we've seen what it's done in Tunisia, and we see what it's doing in the United States with people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. It's very important. The vaccine is effective at preventing people from dying.
Cameroonian authorities urge the public to get vaccinated against COVID-19 after receiving a U.S. donation of vaccines.
Borders are now allowed to move up to 1,800 hours. They are now allowed to carry one passenger. Schools will remain closed until sufficient vaccination of the eligible population and children aged 12 to 18 years old has taken place.
Mixed reactions as Uganda lifts some COVID-19 restrictions.
He says Somalia is endowed with vast natural resources. Among the renewable energy resources include wind and solar energy. Dubo says Somalia's wind speeds are quite high, even the fastest in the world, and this can generate substantial electricity.
And we look at Somalia's great potential for onshore wind and solar power. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Cameroonian authorities are urging the public to get vaccinated against COVID-19 following a U.S. donation of 300,000 Johnson & Johnson doses. Cameroonians can now choose from the Chinese Sinopharm, Oxford AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson jabs, but vaccine hesitancy remains high. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Just 10 civilians have visited the BMRC hospital in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé today to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Among them is Olivia Forby, a 38-year-old vegetable seller. Forby says she wants the Johnson & Johnson vaccine she heard about from Cameroon State Radio.
I've learned that Johnson & Johnson is more than 75% effective in stopping the spread of coronavirus. And secondly, you take it in one dose. Sinopharm and AstraZeneca, you take in two doses. You spend more time going for the second dose.
On July 21, President Joe Biden announced the U.S. was shipping 1.3 million vaccine doses to Africa. Cameroon, Central African Republic, Gambia, Lesotho, Niger, Senegal, and Zambia are the 7 beneficiaries. Mary Dashbash is in charge of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé. She says she handed over 303,050 Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines to the government of Cameroon on Monday.
We don't want to see people dying in Cameroon from the variant that is raging throughout the rest of the world. We've seen what it's done in Indonesia, we've seen what it's done in Tunisia, and we see what it's doing in the United States with people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. It's very important. The vaccine is effective at preventing people from dying.
Dashbach said she was hopeful the 303,050 doses donated by the United States of America will save 303,050 lives in Cameroon. Manauda Malashi is Cameroon's health minister. He says civilians should consider Johnson & Johnson as another life-saving vaccine. He says he is very grateful to the American government and its people for making it possible for Cameroon to have a variety of COVID-19 vaccines. He says he is pleading with people from 18 years and above who are still reluctant to be vaccinated to rush for either the Johnson & Johnson, Sinopharm, or AstraZeneca vaccines and save their lives. Cameroon has received more than 1 million doses since April, but less than 25% of the vaccines have been dispensed. Aliru Bashiru is a 24-year-old cattle seller who has refused vaccination. Bashiru says he prefers local remedies Cameroon government has officially introduced to stop the spread of COVID-19. He says people should trust African healers' remedies and stop believing that all solutions to their health problems must come from America or Europe. This month, Cameroon approved the sale of a herbal remedy from Samuel Kreda, a Roman Catholic bishop in the Central African state. The government said the recipe is supplementary aid to fighting coronavirus infections and was not a cure for COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Uganda has lifted some COVID-19 restrictions after 42 days, while others stay in place. The lockdown of schools remained until the government says some essential workers, including health workers, security personnel, teachers, and those over 45 years old, are vaccinated. Halima Athman reports from Kampala.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni Friday night announced the partial lifting of the COVID-19 lockdown after 42 days. Museveni says the decision was made by the National Task Force after considering a decrease in cases, positivity rates, and hospital admissions. Among other factors, the task force also considered the degree of adherence to safety procedures by the population and the effects of a continuous lockdown on the economy and on residents. However, there are still restrictions even with this partial lifting of the lockdown.
Curfew time is maintained at 7 p.m. Number two, borders are now allowed to move up to 1,800 hours. They are now allowed to carry one passenger. Schools will remain closed until sufficient vaccination of the eligible population of children aged 12 to 18 years old has taken place.
Business centers are now required to clear pathways through rented kiosks, and places of worship remain closed for another 60 days. In addition, outdoor sports events will be held without spectators, and bars and indoor sports activities remain closed until the population is sufficiently vaccinated. With this partial lifting of the lockdown, Museveni says the National Planning Authority and task force officials project that cases could be reduced to 85 per day by the third week and 66 cases per day by the 28th day. Officials are urging the population to observe standard safety procedures to curb the spread of the coronavirus. As of July 29th, Uganda had registered 252 new cases with 29 deaths in the previous 48 hours. Cumulative confirmed cases stand at 93,927. Public transport has been allowed to resume with half the normal number of passengers, and private vehicles are only allowed three occupants. Ugandan Health Minister Jane Ruth Acheng says the COVID-19 mass vaccination program was slowed down by the global shortage of vaccine because the demand outweighs production. Acheng says the Ugandan government has issued a list of vaccines that can be used in the country, including AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer Biotech, Sinopharm, Sinovac, Sputnik V, Sputnik Light, and Moderna, adding that health ministry officials are doing everything possible to obtain vaccines.
Government of Uganda's strategy is mass vaccination of the eligible population of 22 million people, representing 49.8%, as a means of optimal control of the pandemic and full opening up of the economy. Government is doing all it can to access vaccines for the eligible population 18 years and above. In addition, consideration will be given to children aged 12 to 15 years with comorbidities.
In his address, Museveni said schools should continue teaching online, something that has kept many schools and poor students out. Ismail Chisule, a private school teacher, says the past year has been difficult since his income has been cut.
Since the first lockdown, we have not got any hope of going back to teach, which means we have not been getting paid. So when the government says they are going to wait until they vaccinate more people so as to allow us to resume work, it will worsen our situation and force us to drop teaching. Uganda has concluded the legal requirements with the COVAX facility to acquire 9 million AstraZeneca vaccine doses. Additionally, an order of 2 million doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been requested from the African Union, and a down payment of $3 million has been made. Uganda has received 1,725,280 doses of vaccines in the past week from China and Norway. It is still not clear when those vaccines will be distributed. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Last month, riots across South Africa have underscored concerns about inequality and stability after nearly three decades of democracy. In Soweto, owners of pillaged shops accused the government of failing them. Linda Givtash speaks to analysts from Johannesburg.
Muhammad Ali Rondera watched helplessly from outside his electronic shop at a strip mall in Soweto as determined looters broke through its heavy metal gate. In a matter of hours, his livelihood of the past 7 years disappeared. Neighboring shops were also emptied before the one-story building was torched. Nationwide, losses from the unrest that overwhelmed police, destroyed infrastructure, and halted local economies are estimated in the billions of dollars. Small business owners like Muhammad Ali Rondera in Soweto are left asking authorities why.
I'm really disappointed this government, why the government can't open up their hands and do this targeting these people who are doing this nonsense thing. Because not only in my shop, there's a million of people, they lost the business.
Experts say the riots were an eruption of frustrations that have long been simmering among South Africans. Extreme inequality has persisted since the ruling party, the African National Congress, was first elected in 1994. Nelson Mandela University's Ngwe Ndlovu says although it brought freedom to the nation, the ANC has since failed to deliver for the poorest.
But we're seeing now, post-1994, we have a different governance with a different voice, but the conditions are pretty much more or less the same. And then people are angry, people are hungry, and they want to check out this frustration.
President Cyril Ramaphosa announced earlier this week the return of a social grant for those who lost their jobs during COVID-19 lockdowns. Uninsured business owners like Rondera can also expect funding. But Johannesburg-based international relations expert Lisa Jernberg says the response has yet to restore public confidence in the state.
So there is some frustration that everything moves too slowly and that, you know, we hear lots of wonderful promises, but if you're not actually going to carry them through, then what's the point?
Divisions between the Big Ten party are also festering, while allegations of corruption under former President Jacob Zuma's administration mount. But voters are left with few alternatives. Jernberg said opposition parties fail to attract broad support by being too radical or appealing to old racial and ethnic ties. And yet, Jernberg says the unrest may have also revealed the strengths of the country's democracy.
The Constitutional Court held firm. The different people in civil society and the institutions came out in support of the Constitutional Court. And despite the unrest, President Zuma remains in prison, which has to be seen as a triumph for the rule of law.
The country is now closely watching how the law is being enforced on those involved in the riots. More than 2,500 people have been arrested, six of whom face charges for inciting violence. The government has said more arrests are expected. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Somalia lacks a national power grid and relies on imported fuel, wood and charcoal to address its energy needs. But energy experts say with the longest coastline in mainland Africa and an average of 10 hours of sunshine per day, Somalia has great potential for onshore wind and solar power. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia's private power companies rely on imported diesel to meet demand, making Mogadishu power cost more than three times the price of the global average. But they hope to transition to renewable energy. Abdulaziz Ilaika is an electrical engineer with Blue Sky Power, a private energy company based in Somalia. He says that lack of investment hinders money from developing this sector. He says the challenge for the sector is that solar power is relatively new and there is a lack of investment, citing that they have the skills and the technology is readily available, but they lack needed investment to tap onshore and hydropower to make use of these abundant resources. However, he says he is sure they will soon be able to tap these resources. To help jumpstart renewables, a group of private companies this year formed the Somali Green Energy Association, or SOGEWA. Bashir Sofe is the founder of clean energy company Delsan Power and SOGEWA's chairman. He says they face various obstacles such as lack of incentives and investments from both the government and international community. But he says they get the necessary investment and funding, particularly if banks can open their doors to support the renewable energy sector. Then Somalia can become a hub for renewable energy and rise economically. Somalia's Ministry of Planning, Investment and Economic Development says it is pushing renewable energy. Mohamed Dubo is the director of the Somalia Investment Promotion Office, the office tasked with efforts to implement renewable energy. He says Somalia is endowed with vast natural resources. Among the renewable energy resources include wind and solar energy. Dubo says Somalia's wind speeds are quite high, even the fastest in the world, and these can generate substantial electricity. Similarly, he says the country has extended periods of sunshine and therefore the potential to even sell power to its neighbors. A 2018 African Development Bank study found that Somalia has the highest potential of any African nation for onshore wind power if it can harness the wind. Samatar Mohamed, an economics lecturer at Mogadishu University, agrees. He doesn't think the country has been able to unleash its full potential. He says Somalia is not exploiting renewable energy. Maybe it is because the country lacks experience. But if it can take advantage of the country's abundant renewable energy, Mohamed says the price of a kilowatt hour would not be as expensive as it is. The utility rate would be cheap, and everyone would be able to afford electricity. As the world moves to clean energy, Somalia's energy industry hopes to move with it and find its place in the sun. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Cryptocurrencies make headlines for shaking up the financial world, but they are also gaining ground in less developed countries. In Kenya, an American economist who introduced blockchain technology for low-income urban customers has extended the cashless system to the countryside. Ruud Elmendop reports from Kilifi in Kenya.
26-year-old farmer Emmanuel Kahindi in Kilifi is using Kenya's cryptocurrency Sarafu to sell his vegetables and to buy supplies without having to use any cash.
Sarafu menisaidia sana, especially
Sarafu helped me a lot, especially as it makes me save my money, my Kenyan currency. I use Sarafu to purchase things for the garden, like seeds and fertilizer.
Sarafu coins work like vouchers that can be exchanged for goods or services of other users of the currency. Anyone with a Kenyan mobile phone line can enroll with Sarafu. Users are given 50 Sarafu for free. After that, they earn coins by selling a product or service to another user. Sarafu is what's known as a community inclusion currency, or CIC, allowing people to give or take credit without having to deposit Kenyan shillings or other currency in the bank. It was created by an American economist through his Kenyan nonprofit Grassroots Economics.
I think that's just where there's the most chronic lack of national currency. So I think what's happening is we're filling a gap, right? People say, look, the national ledger system, the national currency, it's just not available to us. We can't measure our trade in this thing.
Emmanuel offers his vegetables to a restaurant and gets Sarafu vouchers from the owner.
Sarafu is good because it allows us to get our farm produce straight from the local neighborhood farms and put it on our plate and serve it to our customers, and they're able to pay us with Sarafu.
Bitangan Demo is a senior lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says such community-focused cryptocurrencies have a potential to expand beyond Kenya and in other parts of Africa. He says that cryptocurrencies give communities an option to monetize resources in a way that they can't do with cash, pointing at the cobalt mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo used in smartphones.
Nothing stops them from issuing a cobalt coin based on the reserves that we have in terms of cobalt. And the country then can raise sufficient resources to develop the country.
For Kenya, it would be the agricultural production across the nation and here in Kilifi. For Emmanuel, it's time to relax after work. He used Sarafu to enjoy a well-deserved meal. Ruth Almendorp for VOA News, Kilifi, Kenya.
A United Nations overview of conditions in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province after more than 9 months of civil strife finds the society of staggering devastation of ruined lives and livelihoods. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Thousands of people have been killed and 2 million internally displaced since Ethiopian troops invaded Tigray on November 4th to retake the province from rebel forces. The United Nations reports millions of people are suffering from acute hunger, with some 400,000 on the verge of famine. Malnutrition is soaring, putting thousands of children's lives at risk. Spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says 5.2 million people, around 90% of the population, are now dependent on humanitarian aid for survival.
There's extremely limited time left to halt the rapid deterioration of the food security situation. Trucks should be arriving into Mekele every day. Aid organizations estimate that at least 500 trucks of supplies are needed each week to meet the needs of people in Tigray. That's not happening.
Lajerke notes only one truck convoy of aid supplies has been able to enter Tigray since late June. Newly appointed UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffith is halfway through a six-day mission to Ethiopia. He's expected to travel to Tigray to assess the humanitarian situation for himself. Observers say he will find a desolate landscape full of traumatized people. Lajerke says civilians have been victims of multiple atrocities and abuse by the warring parties.
Horrific violations against civilians have been reported throughout the conflict. This includes the widespread and systematic use of rape as a tactic of war, and more than 1,600 cases of sexual and gender-based violence has been reported since the conflict began. Health facilities have been targeted, attacked, and looted. Only 16 out of 40 hospitals in Tigray are fully functioning. Women and girls who have survived sexual violence have few, if any, place to go for medical help.
Lajerke says UN and private agencies are operating within an extremely dangerous environment. He notes at least 12 aid workers have been killed in Tigray. This includes the brutal murder of 3 staff from the charity Doctors Without Borders on June 24th. The OCHA spokesman says money also is a problem. He says UN agencies require more than $430 million to implement their life-saving operations through the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, should presidents and prime ministers be investigated for alleged crimes after they leave office? We'll discuss the deadly fallout from the jailing of former South African President Jacob Zuma. We'll look at countries that have done it, as well as those grappling with that question. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection.
But first,
the COVID-19 pandemic has led to cuts in foreign aid from donor nations such as Britain, which this month slashed its aid budget by $5.5 billion. The funding loss is being felt in Burkina Faso, where it could shut down a group that helps thousands of survivors of gender-based violence and rape. Henry Wilkins reports from Kaya, Burkina Faso.
Britain has cut its annual aid budget, and so have other countries such as Australia, Japan, and Saudi Arabia. The largest international non-profits say the shockwaves of the cuts will be felt by people across Africa in all kinds of situations and will result in deaths. Sam Nadell is the government relations chief for Oxfam.
For countries like the UK and others to be cutting their aid budgets during a global pandemic is extremely short-sighted, and we know it will put the fight back against poverty by many decades. So the UN Secretary General, for example, called these cuts a death sentence, and it really is that stark for many people.
MSI Reproductive Choices, a group offering family planning to countries in crises, such as Burkina Faso, where over 1.3 million people have been displaced by conflict, is primarily supported by British aid money. The cuts will affect large numbers of women, says the head of MSI Burkina Faso, Dr. Tumbi Sissoko. Overall, MSI has been able to assist more than 500,000 beneficiaries over 2 years, she says. She points to Burkina Faso's context of insecurity, which she says makes women even more vulnerable. Alice, whose name has been changed to protect her identity, received help from MSI after she fled her village in northern Burkina Faso when gunmen attacked. She trekked through the bush for 3 days seeking refuge, but then was seized by a group of terrorists. Alice says they told her to put her daughter down before one of them hit her with the butt of his gun. Knocking her to the ground, six of them raped her, then discussed whether they should kill her. But she says they concluded it was useless to kill a woman. They got on their motorbikes and left. When she reached the relative safety of Kaya the next day, she was directed to MSI Burkina Faso. Alice says a woman from MSI immediately gave her morning after pills and advice. She was still traumatized and could neither eat nor breastfeed her daughter. She said that the woman at MSI encouraged her to eat and told her that her life was still worth living. Flora Gabire works for MSI. She thinks that with the aid cuts, beneficiaries will be left on their own, and the funding to support them won't exist, and many of her organization's workers will be out of a job. For women who fall victim to gang rape, like Alice, it will mean they may no longer receive emergency birth control or support. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
And now in Netline Africa Sports, it's day 9 at the Olympics, Tokyo 2020. Ivory Coast and Egypt were knocked out of the men's football at the quarterfinal stage by Spain and Brazil, respectively. In athletics, Ivory Coast's Jose Marie Talou finished fourth in the women's 100 meters final, just as she did at the Rio Games in 2016. Talou ran 10.91 seconds. But was beaten by the Jamaican trio with Elan Thompson-Herah running the second fastest time ever to retain her title, while another two-time Olympic champion Shirley Ann Frazier-Price took silver and Sherika Jackson claimed bronze. And Grace Nzubechi Nwokocha from Nigeria also failed progress from the semifinals, while Ethiopia's Habitan Alem will be the only African in the women's 800 meters final on Tuesday, as she qualified with the second fastest time of the semifinals. Ugandan world champion Halima Nakai recorded the slowest time of the semifinals and failed to advance. Fellow Ugandan Winne Nanyondo, Benin's Noeli Yoriga, K. Kenya's Mary Mora and Moroccan Rabade Arafi also all failed to progress. South Africa's Wanda Nel finished third in her heat for women's 400 meters hurdles to qualify automatically for Monday's semi-final. Kenya's Ferguson Cheruiyot Rotich was the fastest qualifier from the heats of the men's 800 meters. And on Friday, a quick finish from Ethiopia's Salomon Barega saw him finish ahead of Uganda's world record holder Joshua Cheptegei, who claimed silver in the 10,000 meters, and another Ugandan, Jacobo Kiplimo, who took bronze. Meanwhile, Nigerian sprinter Blessing Okabare is out of the Tokyo Olympics after failing a drugs test. Also suspended for a positive banned substance test is Kenya's 100-meter sprinter Mark Otieno Odhiambo. And in basketball, Nigeria's men were knocked out of the Olympics after suffering a third straight defeat in Group B as they lost 80-71 to Italy. The Tigers had gone into the Tokyo Games with high hopes after beating both the USA and Argentina in warm-up matches before traveling to Japan. And that's it for this edition of Northern Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The war against COVID is being waged differently in many continents with much fervor differently in the different continents. Much progress that had been made in the past weeks about waging this war in Europe and North America was being challenged by the new Delta strain, which seems to be pushing down all the expectation of a turn of the leaf. This is complicated by the fact that many people in these countries are not prepared to follow orders given by the governments on the basis of what they claim to be their freedom and their rights. Not much has been said about how the war is being waged in the African continent, even though from time to time we hear some news about what is going on in South Africa. But overall, it seems that not much is being done because the problem is just too large and difficult. And as I mentioned before, Africa does not have the appropriate weaponry. But Africa can watch, observe, and learn what's being done in other parts of the world. The first point one has to say is that whereas in other parts of the world, Europe, South America, parts of Asia, there are enough vaccine for the population and the governments have launched good programs to apply this vaccine, in Africa, they have to wait until they have gifts of vaccine from the developed countries. This, of course, has irritated many African leaders, but this is what it is. And plans has to be set in motion to deal with that. Right now, there has been some arrangements that there will be production of vaccine in Africa. One was supposed to be in Senegal, in West Africa, and in South Africa, in the southern region. And last week, President of Kenya, Kenyatta, proposed that one site also should be in Kenya. But in drawing up this production center, the African Union should be involved in writing out a protocol, we should learn from what has happened before. India, which was producing a deal of the vaccine, at one time had to stop exporting what it has produced because it itself was overwhelmed with increase in infection in India. Similarly, the European Union had to stop any export produced in Europe because it had also shortage of vaccine. So protocols have to be prepared for that. The next problem that Africa faces is the question of adequate data. Many parts of the world, they have accurate data that are issued almost twice a week or even daily. In Africa, there doesn't seem to be many reliable data. And the time has come for WHO, in cooperation with the African Union, to set up information centers in all of the regional groups in Africa to have accurate data to assist policymakers, like what the UN did with its information centers. So this also should be put online to assist African states. The next thing is to do proper education of the public, to let them realize that these vaccines are normal. They help people and not resort to what we have seen elsewhere, where people have all kinds of stories about what the vaccines do to their body or not. I think when these things are done, Africa will be prepared for what the scientists have already warned, that this Delta variable may be advanced by another difficult derivative after Delta. So this is the preparation that Africa should put with the help of WHO and the African Union. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Headline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. baby super. That's it, Tima, Yeguanja Kira, baby Kaya, baby super. A waka bit you nigga.
Upon me, why, yeah, why, yeah. That poison for me, yeah. Look at your dad. kavumo kanje akira basu bazumfasha kagako tujane kure cyane nubwo bidunda ariko ngera volume niko muri rugere mu gihumbi ubana ngiye gukora fami. Come hold me, baby. You just don't find me.
pas pour te cacher. Ta main reste innocent si tu penses pouvoir tout attraper. Le ciel n'ira pas, il m'a vu essayer de pardonner. À voyage à étage, j'ai pris mes distances et j'ai fui loin de toi. J'ai peur de prendre ton mal et m'attends pas. Ne m'attends pas. Yes, it can be.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.